open the meeting of the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation. First order of business is adoption of the committee rules, and the chair so moves. Is there discussion? They're the same old that you always see. Is there any opposition? Rules are adopted. We'll now move into information meetings. And Patrick, first up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to have an informational meeting. DMV is going to come in and brief us today on the estimates and procedure for cost of compliance with the Federal Real ID Act. So we have those folks ready to come up and join us.
Come on down. Another exciting topic. Another pleasure brought to you by the federal government.
Good morning, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Amy Joyce from the Oregon Department of Transportation.
I am Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator.
So we were invited here today to talk about compliance with the Real ID mandate from the federal government and the costs for Oregon to comply. So we'll start with just a little bit of background on that law. Real ID is a 2005 federal law with 39 specific things that each state must do to its driver licenses and ID cards for security and reliability. The penalty for a state for failure to comply is that that state's driver license or ID card will not be acceptable at federal buildings and perhaps more importantly at airports for getting on an airline, even for domestic flights. In 2009, Oregon passed a law, this legislature passed a law, and the governor signed Senate Bill 536, which directed state agencies to spend no money on Real ID compliance unless the federal government came through and paid for all those costs, and also took particular security measures considering some of the requirements of Real ID. There have been several extensions on enforcement that have been granted by the federal government, and today 20 states are considered Real ID compliant by the Department of Homeland Security. The remaining jurisdictions, including Oregon, have been granted extensions. The last extension was January of 2013. ODOT sent to federal DHS information asserting that Oregon was materially compliant in most areas and had taken security actions that go beyond the Real ID requirements, and asked that our credentials be considered and recognized as valid for airports and federal facilities. The response was an April letter back from DHS, that is part of your packet, in which DHS identified 11 items where DHS found Oregon lacking. And we'll show you here the slide showing all of the states. Compliant are in the green, non-compliant are in the blue. The most recent was Hawaii, which was considered just this August to be compliant. But that gives you an idea of the layout of the country in terms of compliance. Recently, states were told that this fall, DHS would come out with a three-stage schedule of enforcement. That schedule will be, there will be an informational time period in which signs will be posted in airports and federal facilities notifying people about the requirements. Then there will be a soft enforcement stage at which warnings will be given to people that their driver licenses and ID cards will not be acceptable at some point. And then there will be a hard enforcement stage at which for non-compliant states, their driver licenses and ID cards will no longer be acceptable. We don't know what those time periods will be. We're just told this information will be coming, the schedule will be coming, and so we're waiting on that. Department of Homeland Security also informed the states that there will be no blanket extensions, but they may grant states case by case further extensions based on basically on their progress towards compliance. So costs. The estimated cost for Oregon to become fully compliant with Real ID is about $4.8 million in the 15-17 biennium, and then about $5.7 or $5.8 million for the next three following biennia. There are potential additional costs. Perhaps the main one is that part of Real ID was that the federal government was supposed to come out with these databases by which states could check a person's passport and birth certificate and verify that it is accurate or is what it says it is. Those databases do not yet exist, but we presume that when they do come online, to remain or become Real ID compliant, a state would have to, you know, kind of buy into those databases, and there will certainly be cost to that in terms of hooking up to those systems, and then potentially every check would cost money as well. So the main ways in which Oregon is not yet compliant with Real ID, probably the biggest item, is scanning and storing images of people's passports and birth certificates. So today, when a person comes into DMV to renew their driver license, they need to show proof of legal presence. Typically, for a citizen, that's a passport or a birth certificate. They show it to DMV, certain, you know, looking at certain verification elements of those documents, and then that's proved and the person goes away. So under Real ID, DMV would be required to scan those, store those, presumably electronically for efficiencies, and maintain those for at least 10 years. So that's the big ticket item. And also, in terms of Senate Bill 536, the direction from the legislature from a few years ago about security concerns, you know, clearly there's an element there of ensuring that security is maintained on those kinds of records, those primary identity documents. Some of the other bigger ticket items, re-verifying Social Security numbers every time a person comes in. We do that today with your first trip into DMV and showing legal presence. You check against a database that Social Security number is attached to this person who's in front of you. Once that happens today, that sort of locks into the system that's been proved. But under Real ID, every 8 years when you renew, we have to recheck that. There's a charge every time for DMV to do that check. And then there's the additional time that takes.
Charged by who?
By the federal database called Solve. So it's about 50 cents per transaction that they charge us to do that check right there in the field office. So that's an ongoing cost. And marking compliant and non-compliant cards with particular symbols or verbiage, that's part of Real ID. There's a cost to that our vendor will charge to change the markings, and then to add that to every card, there's a cost there as well. So that's the overview of Real ID.
So is your computer capacity, I know you've got, we talked about last week a little bit about this, but is your capacity there to handle this, particularly the ongoing storage?
Chair Beyer, we would have to develop that capability. We do not have that today. We are converting from old microfilm systems today to digital imaging of our current transactions. To be able to do this at the field office would be a new thing for us to put in place. So we don't have the existing systems to be able to handle that.
Is that cost included in the 5.7
Chair Beyer,
per
year? Yes, it is. And the ongoing costs are really staff time, basically, associated. And as she mentioned, costs for lookups and things like that.
Questions? Senator?
Yeah, you mentioned that we passed a bill, and I don't remember it real well. To make it so that you can comply, do we have to do a statutory change?
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, yes, statutory change would be required, as well as obviously significant investment, monetary investment.
I assume it's a budget bill as well. Senator Starr?
Thank you. So the 5.7, 5.8 million, that would be ongoing every biennium into the future as far as you can tell?
Chair Beyer and Senator Starr, I think for the first four biennia, so first 8 years and actually into the next biennia, that high level, it will come down somewhat from there. A lot of that ongoing work is the act of rechecking people's legal presence status. We are 6 years, 5 years now into legal presence, so that many people have already come in with their documents, shown them to DMV, and under current law, they would not need to do that again. All those folks are going to need to bring those back in, have them be rechecked, and now, in fact, scanned and stored. So you'll have another, you know, 8 years or so of that. And then after that, it would trail off, because once you've done that and it's been scanned into the system, now you don't need to bring it back in another 8 years later and have that happen. So we'll trail off after about 8 to 9 years.
Senator Edwards?
Mr. Chair, Amy, do any other states have, say, a compliant ID option or a non-compliant ID option, or is it just your state is just, you know, all of your IDs, all your driver licenses are either deemed compliant or non-compliant because of the system, or, you know.
Senator Beyer and Senator Edwards, I'll take a stab at that, and then Tom may have additional information. I will use as an example Washington State. I'm aware that they have both a compliant card that is sort of the, if you want, let me start again. Their basic card is a non-compliant card. That's what everybody gets. If you choose to, you may go through further rigor, show the documents, what have you, and you can get a card that is Real ID compliant, but that's the extra step. So they do have two different kinds of cards. However, you'll note from the map, Washington is not deemed Real ID compliant. It is possible to do that under Real ID, but I'm not aware of anyone who is.
So then my follow-up would be, as long as Washingtonians that care can get on an airplane because they have an ID that is compliant, what are the consequences for Washington or any state being non-compliant? Or are there consequences other than you can't get on an airplane, but if you have one of those IDs, then you can?
You have a passport, you can.
Right.
Chair Beyer, Senator Edwards, that is the penalty that's imposed in the federal law. It's that your residents who hold those cards would not be able to use those for federal identification purposes. And again, it's the airport is the one that most people are going to be concerned about. It's the TSA agent not accepting that Oregon driver's license for admission. Now, there are alternatives. A U.S. passport is very acceptable to a TSA agent. And that's an alternative. There's also alternative ways for people to get through those checkpoints. If the identity document they provide, they may go through further pat-downs and, you know, checks and interviews to still get through, but it's inconvenient to the person.
It's an interesting irony. So a federal prosecutor who busted somebody that didn't have a real ID compliant card couldn't take him into a federal courthouse.
Have you penciled out what the added cost is going to be for driver's license because of this?
Chair Beyer and Senator Thompson, in terms of, in terms of asking for additional fees to cover the costs, mm-hmm. No, we have not.
Well, let's do some quick math. How many driver's license and ID cards are there statewide, and then divide that into the number? So you're talking about $2 or $3.
Right. So as Chair Beyer and Vice Chair Starr, about a little more than 3 million license holders in the state of Oregon.
So even less than $2.
Thanks.
A little bit of money, but...
Let me ask a question.
Senator Dry.
It doesn't necessarily have to come out of license fees. It could come out of gas tax revenue, could it not?
Could come out of what?
Well, it's an ODOT. It would be an ODOT budget.
Could come out of their budget.
Can it or can it not come? I know gas tax stuff has to be used for highway improvements, but on the other hand, this is part of the licensure requirement. Does it have to come out of license fees, or could it come out of a different pot?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, it could be from any resource available to the department. It is considered a highway fund type activity. Yeah, we do, of course, have the law from 2009, since we can't use state money to become compliant. So that's a bit of an impediment at the moment. We're currently required to use federal money.
But that's a statutory compliance.
That's a statutory restriction that we have today.
Just refresh me again. What's your total budget?
A biennial budget?
Yeah.
It's approximately $170 million over 2 years.
I mean, with the,
in total budget?
Yes.
It's about $170 million to operate DMV over the course of a two-year period.
That's the DMV budget, not the...
Is that what you're asking?
No, I was asking the total ODOT budget.
Oh, I don't know. Top of my head.
I mean, it's in the billions, so... Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that those numbers can pop out of people, but in the total perspective of things, mm-hmm. they're relatively small numbers.
Other questions? Seeing that this is really stupid law. Well, I thought it was a stupid law. I mean, if the feds thought we all ought to have an ID card, they could just create the national ID card out of the Social Security. It'd be a lot simpler and cheaper to do, and probably more secure. But that's not our policy.
And the Real ID Act was a rider on another bill that had to pass without any real testimony or input by the states coming from the federal government.
Excuse me. Stupid law. Yes, Senator Rod.
I'm going to weigh in. I actually think it's something that we need for security. I our personal security when I fly, I want to know that I'm safe when I fly. I fly quite a bit. And I think that there is merit to the Real ID Act. So I would just throw a little disagreement out there.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Senator. I'm just saying if for the security purposes, it's a national requirement, it would have been easier for the national government to do it, rather than each state doing it alone. And it has nothing to do with the driver's license. But that's the federal law. Thank you very much. Patrick,
Chair.
We're up to the next topic.
Well, let's maybe take this stuff a little out of order. Just as an FYI,
okay.
We have three items on our agenda that are sharing panelists with House Business and Labor down the hall. So we're going to be getting them as they come in. So I think the next one up would be the Workers' Compensation Self-Insured Group Legislative Concept.
Good enough.
They are here in the room and ready to go.
Pat, you're up.
So we'll be catching the rest of them as they come down.
Good morning, Chair Byer, members of the committee. I'm Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by John Schiltz, who's the Administrator of our Workers' Compensation Division. We're here to give you a little bit of a heads up about an emerging issue in a small neighborhood of the workers' compensation world and a sneak peek at a legislative concept that we're going to be bringing in the February short session to try to deal with that. Let me start by kind of setting the frame around workers' compensation, since I know we don't come often and mercifully talk in great detail about that with you. Workers' compensation insurance, obviously you have workers, you get insurance, most employers purchase that insurance from commercial carriers, of which Safe is one. A subset, and when they purchase that insurance, there's an assessment on the premiums that they pay, a tax, if you will, of 6.2% that funds the entire worker safety system, Workers' Compensation Division, OSHA, a variety of programs. There's a subset of employers who self-insure, and these are usually large employers around the state. To be able to self-insure, you have to have a minimum net worth, you have to establish a significant cash balance to be able to pay claims, and you get a security deposit, usually in the form of a letter of credit, all of which backs up your ability to pay those claims and keeps the and secures workers' benefits. You pay the same 6.2% tax on premiums. It's a little bit of a calculation we do, since you don't actually pay premiums, but you get the same net effect. And for those self-insured employers, there's a small upcharge, 0.2%, that we add to the 6.2% that goes into a guarantee fund for self-insured employers. Third subset are those employers who are not big enough to self-insure themselves but want to band together and form what we call self-insured groups. And historically, there have been about seven of these groups over time. These groups form an entity, a nonprofit entity, a trust, which then has to have the same collective minimum net worth requirements, maintains a large cash reserve to pay claims, obtains a security deposit, the same circumstance as if they were individually employed or insured. And similarly, there's an upcharge on the premium assessment of 0.2% that funds a separate guarantee fund. And so there's a guarantee fund for groups, and there's a guarantee fund for individually self-insured businesses, and those are separate. Since the beginning of the Great Recession, we have experienced a significant degree of instability within these self-insured groups. A number of years ago, you may recall that a group that was concentrated in the construction industry entered into bankruptcy. It's still in bankruptcy protection right now, being liquidated. And that was precipitated by the huge fall-off in construction activity, causing a number of members of that group to go bankrupt and not be able to pay their assessments for claims. That's a good point to talk about. A key feature of the self-insured groups is they have what's called joint and several liability. And what that really simply means is if you're in the group, you're responsible not only for your own liabilities in that group, but you're responsible for all the other liabilities of all the other group members. And so if a business in a group goes bankrupt, its liabilities are spread out amongst the remaining members of the group. If a number of businesses in a group go bankrupt, that causes the whole thing to become unstable, and in the case of the construction trust, tip over. We have a couple of other groups out there that are experiencing varying degrees of financial stress for a variety of reasons, but we're really still in the echo of the downturn. And as we sit today, my actuaries tell me that I need to, because of that instability, take that 0.2% upcharge for the guarantee fund and increase it to 4% or 20-fold, which is a monstrous increase that I would prefer not to do. What that's really helped us realize is that really there is effectively is kind of a design flaw in the way the group system is set up, and that's what I want to talk about, bringing a concept back to fix. The system is designed first and foremost and almost solely with one objective in mind, which is to protect worker benefits, to make sure that however individual businesses have met this obligation, that under no circumstances will worker benefits be jeopardized, and the system will work absolutely perfectly to do that. The problem is, in doing that, what it will end up doing with some of these groups out there that are focused on Main Street small businesses, nonprofits, those kinds of organizations, is really require them to go into bankruptcy, liquidate, put huge stress on hundreds of small employers that will get the assets we need to pay the claims, but will cause a lot of damage in a lot of communities all around the state in these small businesses and nonprofits. And so what we'd like to do is to try to adjust the system to deal with that. I think you've got an electronic version of an outline of a concept. It looks something like this, and the way I would broadly talk about that is to say there's sort of a carrot and a stick approach to trying to fix this. The top half of this page is the carrot, and what we want to do is we want to provide an orderly opportunity to get out of this as a vehicle for providing workers' compensation insurance for groups and group members for which it really doesn't make a lot of sense. And it really, it's this joint and several liability circumstance that I think is the most disturbing for most of these groups. What we would do is open a window that would be a one-time window that would open and close on dates certain, and offer groups that choose to exit this business, they would go through that window. And what we would do is we would gather in the resources that are available from the group, the large amount of funds to pay claims, the security deposits, all that. We would use that to pay claims. Should there be future claims beyond that, instead of following current law, which would be to do an individual assessment against these businesses, we would use the worker benefit fund to make up that difference if there is any. The worker benefit fund is the fund that's paid by the cents per hour, that's the couple of bucks that shows up on your paycheck. That fund is used to primarily to provide inflation adjustment to worker benefits and provide a variety of other programs as well as bridge funding when there are claims payment problems. We would ask you to authorize us to use the fund for that purpose. We would also ask you to allow us to make some adjustments to the statutory amount of the fund balance required to be maintained. Right now we have to maintain a 12-month fund balance. That's different than all of our other funds and is reasonably arbitrary. Most of our funds are managed on a 2 to 4 month balance basis, and we would ask you for a period of time to allow us to manage at that same level. for businesses that choose not to then take that opportunity to go through that window and orderly exit from this as an insurance vehicle, the bottom half of the page that I've given you is effectively the stick, and it represents a number of ways that we significantly beef up the security and the backstops to assure that we can't, that it's much less likely that we can be in a situation like this again. And again, I won't go in painful detail through those, but mainly they have to do with a number of technical standards and accounting principles and deposit requirements that would have the effect of raising the deposit amounts to provide a much more significant protection against defaults. Also, we would try to insulate. I talked about this assessment going from 0.2% potentially to 4%. What we would try to do is insulate groups from each other, so that it would be much less likely that by virtue of the assessment going up, it would cause other groups to then become unstable and become kind of a domino circumstance. Again, I say this is a concept that we'll bring in February. We've been vetting this extensively with stakeholders. We have not been to MLAC yet, though we expect to before the February session. We've got significant support from labor business groups that are engaged in workers' compensation issues. We've gotten strong feedback that although this is an undesirable place to be, that this design seems to be an effective way to try to deal with the problem. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions you might have. Or John would be happy to answer questions.
Colleagues, a note for the record that this is something that Pat did bring to both Senator Starr and I, and we've agreed that this is an appropriate subject for us to take up in February, stabilizing the system. Obviously, no commitment that we'll buy it, but that's the issue there, and we certainly will be looking to MLAC for a recommendation on this. Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pat, so we are talking about groups leaving the system, not members of the group leaving the group.
That's correct.
Okay.
Other questions? Got an easy path this morning.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we're going to stand at ease for a minute.
We are.
We're going to have to. We don't have anybody left.
My golly, we're just too efficient.
Okay. I'll go down and check, but
all right, let's stand at ease for.
It won't be too long. That's like I said, it's going to be a rolling start, so we expect the DMV.
We talked about.
We'll take up the workforce. Hello? We're ready to go again. We're going to take up the workforce redesign program and welcome up Lisa and Agnes and Andrew. I hope this isn't the redesign.
Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Starr, I'm Agnes Balassa with the Governor's Office. I'm the Governor's Workforce Policy Advisor. I have with me today Lisa Neisenfeld, the new Director for the Oregon Employment Department, and Andrew McGough, the Director for Work Systems, Inc., a local workforce investment board. And we're here to spend some time talking about an effort to redesign a component of the workforce system that specifically focuses on helping unemployed and underemployed Oregonians get back to work as quickly as possible and helping businesses find the skilled workers that they need in order to fill their openings. By way of background, this is the first presentation we're doing formally on this effort. As we've been focusing laser-like on this component of the workforce system, we're doing so primarily because of an ongoing concern, a growing concern that we've been thinking about and looking at, which is we could be extremely successful in achieving our 40-40-20 goals. We could help educate every Oregonian in the state and still potentially not have the levels of employment that we're looking for people to achieve prosperity. And so the governor has charged a group of us with looking at a component of the workforce system, the component that specifically focuses on unemployed and underemployed individuals, and better aligning and better supporting that system. In this last recession, we've seen changes to our economy that fundamentally have challenged the way we provide these services. For the first time in our history, or at least in recent history, we have been in a post-recession era with minimal job growth, yet companies talking about the fact that they're having challenges finding the exact workers that they need. And so we've been looking at this set of approximately 14 to 18 federal, mostly federally funded, some state-funded programs that have employment as one of their primary missions. These are the programs that help individuals get jobs, keep jobs, and move up career ladders by providing a variety of services, and referral to education is one of those services. Better connection to training is one of those. Just by way of example, the folks who come into this system range from very low-skilled to very high-skilled. A lot of the people that we see are people who've had good work histories, who have been employed for long periods of time and find themselves for the first time out of work. Some of those people need whole-scale retraining because the jobs that they used to be in no longer exist. Others just need a little bit of help cleaning up a resume, getting their interview skills, adding a certification perhaps. And so this is a system that tries to figure out what all of those things look like. On the flip side, this is also the system that works with businesses that often have difficulty filling positions. One example, there's a company in Eugene that just came across my radar recently. They were looking for a specialized skill set, and they weren't finding it in terms of what they do is they do wireless networking and wireless system development. And they weren't finding it in terms of people who are coming right out of school because they had a set of expectations that were on top of that. Through the workforce system, they worked to implement an on-the-job training program that helped them better identify the specific training needs so that they had somebody that had 80 to 90% of what they needed. They could, in fairly short order, get that last 10 to 15 to 20% on the job to be able to function, and in the end wound up hiring not one, but several employees at the same time, because now with a training plan they were able to bring on a whole group. And so this is a system that serves a lot of different masters, provides a lot of different services, and in our estimation, needs to be a stronger platform. And so one of the reasons we're coming to you today is because we're specifically going to be looking at the employment department as a key component of that platform, strengthening the department and making some adjustments to the way services are provided. But to do that, we need to do some alignment of the overall workforce system. And so the picture that Senator Beyer referred to initially is what we currently have. Currently, the way the system is structured, and I'll start from governance and work my way down, we have one agency, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, that has two boards over it. One is the Higher Education Coordinating Council. The other is the Workforce Investment Board. The Workforce Investment Board is required by federal statute in order for us to receive the $46 million funds that are in funding that are in the purple on this chart on the community college side. Most of those dollars come directly from the feds. However, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board has responsibility for the programs that are also at the employment department, but no direct authority for them. And so you have a bifurcated system where you've got one agency with two boards over it, another agency that has a huge number of the programs and about half the funding without any direct connection to the board that is intended to oversee it. You also see that in the employment department, our big leverage point is that we have the UI investment there, and clearly our goal is to have these services that are in the purple better help the folks who are receiving UI get back to work in a more efficient and effective manner and be able to start to move along career ladders as well. And so that's part of what we're talking about, is how to better leverage a set of services that are in the employment department that help unemployed and underemployed people get back to work by cleaning up a governance structure that has been confusing and frankly has created a lot of confusion on the ground level where the services are delivered. Because as you go down the chart, you'll see seven local workforce boards who are responsible for managing services in 40-plus one-stop centers, worksource centers, yet they have very little connection to the staffing and resources that are provided through the employment department except through partnership and handshake agreements. And so that creates a certain set of dissonance and noise. And in a system where we have reduced resources, every dollar that's spent figuring out who's in charge of which activity, who's in charge of making things happen, how do we work together, is a dollar that isn't going into direct frontline customer services. So that's essentially what we're trying to clean up with this effort. We'll go to the next slide.
So Agnes, before you move on, I have a question.
Yes.
We're focusing primarily on that $46 million
yes.
of grant money.
Yes.
How much flexibility does the state and the legislature have over how that money is used? How much of it is statutorily or formulaic pass through to the local level?
Senator Beyer and members of the committee, the money that comes to the Department of Community Colleges through the Workforce Investment Act Title I program is by the federal law required to go to local workforce investment boards.
So use the title I'm not familiar with. Is that what you're referring to as the $46 million?
Yeah.
So
yes.
That
yes.
money is, okay.
Yes. So by law, all but about 5% of it is required to go to the local workforce investment boards, who then invest it in a variety of services. Some of those services are prescribed. There's also some flexibility about exactly how they invest. It goes out by a formula. The flexibility that we do have is the ability to adjust the formula. But other than that, there's about 5% of administrative dollars that stay at the state level. Does that adequately answer the question?
Yeah, so we don't have a lot of control over how that money is spent.
No.
Local decision.
There is policy guidance that the State Workforce Board provides through the implementation of a 5 years to 10 year state plan. And so the state plan provides clarity about what outcomes those dollars should be achieving. The state plan creates clarity about a handful of strategies. We're very much in the tight, loose construction here where we don't prescribe exactly what every dollar goes for, but instead we prescribe some strategies through the state board, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, that the locals then identify how they will implement through local plans.
Do you have a sense of the money that goes to the local governments or local boards? How much of that is subsequently contracted to community colleges to provide training?
Sure. So I don't have exact numbers on that, but we can get approximations on that. We don't have an accounting system that captures everything, but we can get you some estimates there.
You have sense?
I don't.
Well, in my region, which is City of Portland, Multnomah, Washington
County. Could you put your name on the record, please?
Yeah. Andrew McGough, Executive Director of Work Systems. In our region, about 65% of the formula resources go to local community colleges, and then other resources that we bring to the table, either through competitive grants or local relationships, probably upwards of 80% wind up in with the community colleges.
Okay, so 60-80% is a fair guess.
So, Chair Beyer and members of the committee, it varies significantly from local area to local area. Portland is probably the highest percentage. And just to clarify, there's two ways that those dollars go to community colleges in the Portland area, through contracts to provide services. So PCC and Mount Hood Community Colleges provide the staffing in the one-stop centers under contract for the Title I program that we just talked about, the Workforce Investment Act Title I program, and they also receive training dollars in the Portland area. Clackamas also is in the same situation. In other parts of the state, colleges have not necessarily been the competitors for those funds because it's a competitive process by which that staffing is procured. But they do receive training dollars. I would say more in line of about anywhere from 10 to 25% of the overall funding, because you don't have the bulk of, you don't have the contracts to provide the full range of services. So.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I'm happy to answer the questions. And so I'm going to actually hand this over to Lisa to talk about where we're headed with this, because ultimately the goal that we're trying to achieve is to take that $46 million, pair it with the $51 million, the $51 million that's in the purple over which the OWIB has responsibility, in order to create a better platform to provide a more robust mix of services. Because in our current economy, the mix of services we have, which are primarily job-seeking services, resume-building services, interview skill services, and some training services, don't meet the full needs that we have in front of us. And so what we're looking to do is create a platform where we can provide a more robust array of services.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Neisenfeld, and I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. I've been in that capacity about 8 weeks now. So, and it's been a very entertaining 8 weeks. Working on this project has been very exciting for a variety of reasons. One is that one of the features of the project is that we'll be able to recognize the differences in local economies and drive more decision-making to local levels, so that what Portland needs doesn't necessarily have to be what Pendleton needs, that we can really begin to distinguish between the service array and economic development needs of different communities and respond accordingly. This design brings those services. Agnes talked about the one-stop centers. I know that's confusing. It's also on your paper, that's Worksource Centers. That's our name for the one-stops throughout the state. That's a joint enterprise between the local workforce investment boards and the state employment department. We all have staff in them. Right now, those staffs are not very well integrated. The employment department offers these services that you see under the $51 million box, and the workforce boards offer through their contractors, or sometimes directly now, although that will shift to contractors soon. They offer the services under the Workforce Investment Act. As we begin to better integrate those functions, I believe that we will be able to help our local boards free up more of their investments in staff, because we'll be able to fund most of those functions related to job match, counseling, working with employers, free up more resources for training so that we can fund more community college service through that project. We'll also be looking to refer people to apprenticeships, private career schools, and other training mechanisms, employer-based training, for example, to make that happen. Finally, we'll be looking at working closely with local employers. Often what we're seeing in the economy right now is that we haven't done very well in the last 20 years of moving people up the road in skills inside companies, and lacking as the baby boom retires, when we lack those higher level technicians and supervisors, the company can't hire the entry-level people that we're producing out of the colleges. So sometimes we're going to need to be able to work with both existing workers as well as those incoming workers. We think that this move of the Workforce Investment Act funding to the Employment Department lets us take a lot of the friction out of the system, to have one state agency providing guidance to the local workforce boards as well as to the WorkSource centers as that joint project. So I'm going to let Andrew talk about specifics of how it looks at the local level. If there are no questions.
Questions?
I do later.
Senator Durant?
Go ahead. I have a question later.
Later. Oh, welcome. Excuse me.
And Chair Beyer, if I may, before we go there, just one other thing I'd like to point out on this is one of the glaring challenges that you will see if you look at this chart is that currently we do not have a strong connection between the Higher Education Coordinating Council and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. That's a conversation we're very interested in engaging in and figuring out exactly how these two boards can work together, because the reality is there's a lot of shared space here. We care about work-ready communities. Education community cares about work-ready communities. Economic development cares about work-ready communities. We care about career pathways. We all care about making sure people have foundational skills, making sure that there's enough career and technical options for people. And so there's a shared space in there that's not currently addressed that we're trying to figure out right now in terms of how to assure that all of these systems are working together and not potentially at cross purposes. And so we hope next time we have this conversation to have a little bit more of an answer on what that interconnection could look like.
Andrew?
Thanks, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Again, my name is Andrew McGough. I'm the Executive Director of Work Systems. We're the local workforce investment board serving the city of Portland, Multnomah, and Washington counties. And thanks again for your time this morning. I'm really here to give some local perspective on the recommendations being proposed by the governor's office, and also to share our experience in helping to build a more effective public workforce system. So I thought I would start by going backwards a little bit. And so I'm going to jump back to 1970, to the year 2007, when really this idea started to emerge at the state and local level that, you know, maybe we needed to do something a little bit differently with this workforce stuff. And at the time, I think there was sort of this collective epiphany that we had these two systems who had and shared an ultimate goal of trying to put people back to work. But beyond that kind of shared mission, there was not a lot of interaction or engagement either at the state or the local level. So, you know, as a result, we did a lot of very similar work, but it was isolated and it was inefficient. It was confusing to the public, and overall, I think it was much less effective than it could have been. So in 2008, as Lisa mentioned, local workforce investment boards and the Oregon Employment Department and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development sort of got together and said, we need a better way to do this, and WorkSource Oregon was born. So sort of the guiding principles around WorkSource Oregon, both at the beginning and as we've continued to evolve the system, was we got to look at integrating services at any possible place that we can. Common customers are essential to assuring that we're driving resources and programming in a way that creates a more comprehensive package of services. We need to keep a focus on increasing the skills of people coming through the system. And then finally, you have to have shared outcomes as a mechanism to align staff and create the kind of synergy at the staff level to move people to places where we want them to be. So today, if you look at WorkSource Oregon, and I'm going to be the first to admit this is not a perfect system. However, what we have is an agreed-upon delivery and outcome framework that is used statewide So the idea really is that the process flow and outcomes are similar regardless of where you are in the state, but how it's delivered, again, back to Lisa's point, varies depending upon local circumstances. It's really very closely aligned to the governor's philosophy of sort of tight on the what, loose on the how, and I think this is a demonstration of that. So if we wanted to sort of look at our progress, I'm right now collecting information from my colleagues across the state, but what I can say is right now we're looking at about 40 different funding streams are now aligned through the WorkSource system. In terms of common customers, in 2012 we served 211,286 customers, and you know, this is sort of this is really the essential kind of challenge for this system, because again, these are federal resources and no one loves a silo better than the federal government. But I can tell you, we've sort of figured it out here in Oregon, and we're making really significant progress. And just sort of by the way, this number represents the fifth highest WIA number in the nation. So Little Oregon is number five in the nation. This system has really improved access for a broad array of people. Last year, we served over 20,000 people of color. We served over 13,000 veterans, 53,000 people above the age of 50, over 12,000 ex-offenders, 55,000 people receiving food stamps, 21,000 people with no high school diploma, and one that shocks a lot of people, 27,000 people with a bachelor's degree or above. So I think the point in all of this is really that our public system is serving a wide range of customers who have a variety of needs, circumstances, and goals. And I think that goes back to what Agnes was talking about earlier. Integration has really helped us more effectively accommodate our diverse customer base and make the connections people need to improve their skills, pursue training, or simply reconnect with the labor market. So in terms of outcomes, during that period of time, we placed more than 171,000 people into jobs. 9 months later, 83% of those people are still working. And most importantly, to a state like Oregon that's so driven by income for its public services, over the first 6 months after placement, those 171,000 people earned almost $2.5 billion. So this is not a small or non-consequential system. This is an important driver of the state's economy, and I think we need to pay attention. And just to give some local perspective, a little bit more return on investment. Now, this is specific to our region. Since 2008, we've raised more than $36 million in competitive resources and aligned those dollars with the public WorkSource system, which enhances services, allows us to more effectively serve a wide variety of populations. And then finally, most recently, the city of Portland has decided to invest almost $2 million in community development block grant resources in the public workforce system in partnership with community-based organizations across the city, which again is intended to partner with, to help us better serve low-income individuals and people who have been or are experiencing significant barriers to employment, use the public system to reconnect with the labor market. So I guess my final point is the bottom line for my board and my community is that the change initiated by this workforce systems redesign that we've undertaken since 2007 and that's being proposed now has been a tremendously value-added thing for our community and our residents, and we would encourage you to continue to help us down this path, because I think we're headed in the right direction. thanks a lot, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Andrew, I would start off by a comment saying that I think your numbers, your date's wrong. This division of discussion didn't start in 2007. It actually started in the 1960s. I came into this picture by accident. It was one of my first professional jobs in the early 1970s and happened to be on a panel speaking to employment department professionals over in Celestine, as a matter of fact, with one of Lisa's predecessors, a fellow named Ross, Ross Morgan, who was telling his colleagues at that time, don't worry, this slidiness will soon be over and we'll move it all, the feds will move it all back into our department. So the discussion goes on. It's an important discussion, and I think I appreciate you bringing it here, but I know that you're well aware that some of your partners in this discussion don't agree at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So the community colleges are significant concerns about that. The only other thing I would mention about your chart that concerns me, and I think we have talked about this a little bit, is that you have the HEC on here, but you don't have the OEIB. And one of the things that's missing that, you know, the legislature has been discussing is the governor, when he came in, created the OEIB. The legislature created the HEC, and we haven't yet quite figured out how all of that works together. But I think we need to have that discussion on this kind of thing as we get into session and how it all fits together. And Senator Girard, you had a question.
I do. You talked a lot about the interface between workforce development and the community colleges. One thing I didn't see is the interface between apprenticeship programs and workforce development. And I'm one to believe that that interface is probably just as important, if not more so important. A person that gets a welder certificate is employed like that right now. So would you care to comment on that, and why don't I see that in these little charts?
Senator Beyer and Senator Girard, that was a question I asked when I came into this job of why isn't the Bureau of Labor and Industries in here, and the answer was, well, that part of the system is not broken. It's working really well, and so they continue to be a very important partner. I believe I mentioned them in my comments. You're correct, they're not on the chart, and we will try and get them there. It's one of the reasons why we don't assume that a community college education is right for everyone. In fact, it's not. A lot of people require other sorts of solutions, and while the community colleges provide the main solutions, and they are an important partner in almost all apprenticeships, there are other strategies that are more important for particular individuals. Apprenticeships are an extremely strong one. It is a very, very low-cost strategy for the public, and we think it needs to be expanded.
Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, just one thing we haven't said is that this is only the first phase of a longer effort. Our first effort was really just to line up the infrastructure that has created the greatest dissonance and noise compared to how it's being delivered on the ground. So the programs that Andrew described in terms of how they're being delivered on the ground, what we're trying to do at the state level is parallel that construction by providing the same kind of alignment at the state level to take a piece of the noise out of the work that they're doing. But we do have two more phases on this work, which is to look at the workforce system writ large, to continue to identify exactly how we work more closely with the HEC, the OEIB, the colleges, to assure that we meet that middle 40 goal and that that people who achieve degrees and certificates in that middle 40 are employed at the end of that work. And then we also have a piece to look at social services programs that also have employment as a primary goal. Andrew mentioned the number of people that are on food stamps in the system. Clearly, we have a lot of users of the system who are also using other social services programs, and our intent is to better understand how and when those folks enter into this component of the system. Lisa will be conducting a series of statewide meetings sometime in the next year?
March through May
of the next year to engage in design conversations so that we can have form follow function. We've had, since 2007, we have had practice at trying to integrate this at the local level. We have not had the practice to try to integrate all the others, and we wanted to have that local design lead statewide infrastructure recommendations.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that kind of came to light, I was in Denver just recently, is that The low-hanging fruit for us as far as education goes, oftentimes is people that went to college, quit, and then took a job, and now they've lost their job. Do you have specialty programs to try to funnel these people back onto a course to get a degree, which still is very financially beneficial to most people? Yeah.
So, Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, I know that there are efforts within the colleges to capture those credits and identify how to move folks forward. As we talk about new tools that we can have in the Worksource Center, placing programs like that in so that we can better identify who's got prior learning that could be captured and articulated into a few more articulated with a few more courses to get to degrees, better implementing things like credit for prior learning assessments as the colleges start to do credit for prior learning on a more comprehensive basis. We've got other committees working on those topics. At some point, the Worksource Centers would be in a position to identify potential candidates who come in, because what happens is when people walk into Worksource, they don't walk in thinking of themselves as students. They walk in thinking of themselves as dislocated workers without a lot of hope. They wouldn't come to us if they felt like they could do this on their own. Our job is to help them figure out which ones of them are ready to be students, which ones can do it fairly quickly and easily, which ones need more intense interventions. Do they have their financial aid together? Will they have the tools in place to succeed? If we spend our public dollar sending someone to a college program who doesn't have a chance of succeeding and completing, who ends up in remedial courses, et cetera, we've just set them even further behind and spent the public dollar on a service that hasn't resulted in an end goal, which for us is got a job, kept a job, got a wage gain, right? And so we need to be able to put in a more comprehensive set of services in our counseling divisions. And with the budget cuts that we've seen across all of these programs over the last 10 years, that's some of the capacity that's eroded. We're hoping by putting these programs together, creating some efficiencies, we can rebuild that capacity and do a more effective job with our public dollar to assure student success.
Yeah, I really liked your answer, but I kind of want to take it one step further, because we talked about the interface between community colleges and workforce development, but I do think there needs to be, you brought it up, an interface between the four-year institutions and workforce development, especially on the assessment of, like, the military when they come out, make sure that, you know, that these people have credits. They end up in community colleges because they don't get the leg up that they should in the four-year universities. So it seems to me that that's another area besides apprenticeships that you might be looking at a small interface just to see for those people coming out of the military or have a select set of job skills that we can push into a four-year university and even get them a better degree.
Absolutely.
Senator.
Thank you. I attended one of your presentations at the Dalles.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
And I was just wondering how I'm assuming you went to all the different regions this summer or this fall, or have you been to all the regions?
So, Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, we engaged in about a 6-week-long stakeholder process that covered large parts of the state, but not all of the state. One of our next phases is to get further out into rural Oregon. I've been working with, I met on Monday with a group of county commissioners to talk about setting that up and starting to do some planning around that. We did as much as we could cover in 6 weeks. We also had a number of statewide groups that we brought together where you had representation from rural regions, but we didn't necessarily get to every rural community we had intended to.
Just to follow up, I just some of those, how were these changes in some of the other parts of the state besides Multnomah?
Right. So, Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, the rural challenge for us is huge, as you're well aware. Part of the rural challenge is not just in terms of delivering workforce services, but finding the right set of services, because our potential there, as we continue to educate our populations, as you know, is if there's no jobs, they will move out of those communities and bankrupt those communities. We have a strong commitment as an administration to supporting rural communities and assuring that every person who wants to stay and has the opportunity to create a future for themselves there. And so my belief is, as we start to look more at the rural question, we'll be having a lot more conversations about entrepreneurship. We'll be having a lot more conversations about how we can use internet capacity, not only to provide services, but also to help people make a living. We're looking at models in some other states. Kentucky's got some interesting models where they're building a telecommuting community in rural communities who are actually providing services across the country from their homes. And they've created a network to pull that together. And so I believe we will have a number of very different conversations because the questions about access are about distance there as opposed to how long you wait in line at an overflowing one-stop center in the Portland area. They're very different types of questions. And so we recognize that, but part of the design conversation that Lisa's going to be leading, I believe, is where we can have a lot more detailed conversations about that.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Anyone else? Well, thank you very much. We look forward to this discussion in February, I suppose.
Thank you very much, yes.
Okay, thank you. So, Paul, you're up next. Patrick, anything, any lead-in on that?
Oh, no, Mr. Chair. We had an update in September on highway projects, and normally that September update is the last one we need because the construction season ends, but Paul's going to tell us some updates there. I have some actual updated information on some of these. Plus, you know, we only had one-third of a committee in September, so.
There you go. Welcome, Paul.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Changes.
Oh. I did change my good
PowerPoint. Somebody else's slide.
I think
good morning again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'm just going to give you a quick tour of updates on a few projects we've been working on this summer. We've had a very busy construction season, which actually has carried over into the fall. We had kind of a wet spell in September, but then as the weather cleared up in October, our contractors were able to take advantage of that and do quite a bit of work. So I've actually got some updated photos from just the last couple weeks of some of the project work that we've been doing, just to quickly walk you through. I'd start with the Brookwood Interchange. This is on the Sunset Highway, a JTA project funded with $48 million from the Jobs and Transportation Act. The project which just began this year. Wildish out of Eugene is the contractor. Earlier, a few months ago, we had a nice groundbreaking ceremony out there to recognize the event of starting work on this important project. It's an important project just that it's going to facilitate the traffic and the transportation needs of all the growth that's happening in that portion of Washington County. As you know, there's a lot of growth happening out there today, and there's other planned, and this will be an important aspect of the transportation system to support that. Here's a photo of some of the work that Wildless has been able to get done. You can see here some of the alignment of the frontage roads that we're realigning to expand the interchange. If you notice down here in the bottom, there's actually a culvert that they put in during the in-water work period that will facilitate the widening of Brookwood there. So some of that preliminary work is underway. Similarly, on the Sunrise Corridor, another important economic portion of the state, and particularly for the Portland metro area. If you've heard me talk about this project in the past, this is a $130 million project. About $100 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. Kerr Contractors out of Woodburn is the local contractor. That's the prime on this project. Here we are at the east end of the project. You can see they've been able to take advantage of the good weather and do quite a bit of work in the new alignment and putting some of the base work, earth work that's been in place on that end of the project. You can start to see how it's taking shape there around some of the industrial areas. One of the things that we had the contractor do is add this sound wall in here. It was part of the plans, but we asked them to do that early on in the project just so the neighbors there would enjoy the benefits of that sound wall during construction and the construction noise that's happening.
As you drive on 205, one of the things you'll notice is the work they're doing to build a new structure across 205. It's kind of hard to tell in the aerial photograph there, but they're doing some of the foundational work for that structure. As you drive by there, you'll see the cranes and some of the other work going on to build that structure. That's some of the work they can do through the winter months before it dries out in the spring to do more of the earthwork. Woodburn Interchange is another Jobs and Transportation Act. This is about an $80 million project. Just over $50 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. This will be a project that lasts several summers as we kind of phase the work in. Most of the work there on Highway 214, 219, we'll be doing kind of different halves of the street to minimize impacts to the businesses in that area. The work that's going on now, as you drive up and down I-5 or use the interchange, you'll see the loop ramps in each of those quadrants that they're working very aggressively on, again, taking advantage of some of the dry weather we've had the last few weeks to begin that earthwork in each of those quadrants. You'll notice in the upper left there is the transit center. They've got that about 95% complete. They've got a few more illuminations to put in and some bus shelters, but that'll be functional and operational here shortly.
Can I ask a question on that project? Is it just on I-5, or if you were, I guess it would be west, are you changing any of the interchanges on the frontage road, or not the frontage road, but the crossroad there?
So your access.
As you're going west, the mall's in there. So when you leave mall, you got to.
Right, the outlet is here, and as you come out of the outlet mall, your access is here.
That's a mess.
That access will continue to be the same, but what will be different is your access onto the freeway, and so it'll facilitate a much smoother movement to and from the freeway. So you'll have this loop ramp in here and a loop ramp.
Are you changing any of the lanes coming out of the mall? I mean, is there any widening at all?
There'll be some widening. As you'll see the blue here, this will all be widened as part of that.
Okay.
And there'll be some realignment of the frontage road here. This portion here will stay as it is today.
How does it improve the access to the freeway going back east?
Mr. Chair, I think the biggest improvement we're going to see is today you have multiple left turns that happen at each of those traffic signals. By putting those loop ramps in, you're taking out two of the left turns, one at each of those intersections. So you're only going to have one left turn at each of those signalized intersections. And those signals will be able to operate almost exclusively for the through movement, and you'll have some very minor delay for the one left turn that you'll have at those intersections. Today you have multiple left turns that happen to and from the freeway ramps. All of those except one will be taken out with these improvements. In addition, you'll have a much wider structure across the freeway, which will facilitate more lanes traveling through.
I see.
So this will accommodate 90%, 95% of the congestion that we see there. If you go there the day after Thanksgiving, or maybe now the day of Thanksgiving, you're still going to see a fair amount of congestion that happens.
So we're not going to have people parking in the center lane of I-5?
Yeah, you'll have some of that, but not near as much as we've had in the past.
You'll like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I was telling Paul yesterday, I saw him yesterday, I was telling him I was thinking about getting a tattoo of that interchange on my arm there.
Another important project for us. We're trying to facilitate improve the congestion, alleviate the congestion that goes through Newburgh and Dundee. We have a large project that's been through the environmental process that's shown in the upper box there, the full bypass piece. The amount of funding we have, we've scaled that back to what's shown there in the lower portion, which represents about a $250 million project. Almost $200 million of that comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. We've begun work construction on that piece. We've divided that up into several different contracts to bring the size of those contracts down where Oregon contractors can be competitive on those and phase those as we complete the design work. The first phase of that is from Ledoux Contractors out of Southern Oregon. They've been doing work this last summer and some of the foundational work on the bridges. There's a small creek crossing on the kind of the Dundee end of the project. And as you move towards the 219 end of the project, you can start to see the shape of the roadway start to take place there, and they do some of that foundational work. We'll have a much larger contract, actually two contracts, going to bid next year. Basically, one contract will be working on one half of the project and the other on the other half, and we'll have a golden spike hopefully in the middle, and have those two meet up. But again, trying to scale the project in a way that we can have local contractors be competitive with the project.
So will that be similar to what was done years ago in McMinnville with that bypass?
Senator Beyer, I believe so, yes. I mean, if I'm visualizing what you are there in the Highway 18 bypass around by the airport
one out
and so
around
forth,
the city.
It'll act similar to that. We won't have traffic signals. We won't have as much access. This will be a fully access controlled without traffic signal access, except at 219, this intersection here. We're still doing some work at the south end, the design work. We've had some concerns from the citizens about how that connection is at the south end. We're hoping that if we have some savings from some of these projects, I'll be back before you to asking for transferring some of the JTA monies to address that south end connection.
Is that where most of the congestion is on the 99?
Current congestion is through downtown Dundee and Newburgh. If you go through there just about any day, but particularly on the weekends,
it's really bad in Dundee because you narrow down to those two lanes, plus you slow the speed up. I was out there on a Sunday evening 2 weekends ago, and the traffic coming from the coast through there was just backed up for miles.
Yeah.
Sunday. They're all coming back from the beach on the weekend.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's been on the desk forever.
Just a quick update on Pioneer Mountain Eddyville. Again, I've talked to you about this in the past. We've transitioned from our design-build contract to one that's led by ODOT, moving from a design that's based on bridges in this section to one based on fills and culverts. The majority of this project, so all this section through here and then on this end of the project is complete. Where we're focused on is the intense work through this kind of rugged area through here that we've had the landslide issues. So from a kind of an aerial photograph view, the majority of this project is complete. It's really that very difficult section in the middle that we've been struggling with. And we've been transitioning from a design based on structures to one based on culverts and fill, knowing that the culverts and fill are much more tolerant of slight movements in the earth and in landslides and so forth, where bridges don't tolerate that very well at all. So we've been working this summer. K&E Contractors out of Salem had a project to install the culverts and the foundational work. These culverts are very large. They're 6-foot culverts. I think they come in pieces of four, kind of quarter sections. They installed over 73,000 bolts in putting the four culverts together. So the scale of the project is very impressive. You get a little piece of it. Of the scale of the project here, this probably represents 10% of the project. And so you can imagine, if you haven't been out there, it's an impressive project from a scale standpoint. What K&E has been able to get done this summer is install 3 of these culverts, and then in this area where you see the fabric in place, they've actually put rock in place. And so what we'll do next summer on top of that is do the in earthwork movement, and we'll basically take earth from the high points and put them into low points build the roadway section, and that'll take the next 2 summers. We have a very short construction window, being in the Coast Range. We have about 90 to 100 days each year to do work. Contractors, we anticipate to work around the clock in both those summers to complete that work.
So, what do you suggest or estimate that will be open?
We're still on track, Chair Beyer, to open in 2016.
2016.
Yep. The Wyoming River Bridge in Eugene on I-5 is really kind of the crown jewel of a program we've been working on for the last 10 years. The OTIA 3 bridge program addressed 365 bridges across the state. We are in the very final stages of that program. We have one bridge that's left under construction. We will bring that program, that $1.3 billion program, in under budget. And on time. And this bridge, I think, really represents a lot of the benefits that we've seen from this program and the success of the program. This bridge was built by a group of contractors led by Hamilton Construction out of Springfield, and it really was a a success from the standpoint of working with the community. We've had difficulties, you know, building large bridges in some communities. Eugene Springfield, building projects in particular can be a challenge, and this bridge, I think, really, this project really allowed us to work with the groups of citizens down there with both cities, and is really something I think all the community in ODOT is very proud of. We had an opportunity to do some events to celebrate that. One was a group of dignitaries to kind of do the formal dedication, but then we opened it up for a weekend and allowed just citizens to come up and enjoy the bridge before we opened the traffic. We had lines of people waiting to get up on the bridge and enjoy the bridge with their bicycles or just walking across the bridge.
Senator?
Yeah, I'd just like to add a comment. You mentioned about having trouble with bridge projects. I'm just hoping there's one bridge project you continue to have problems with.
Paul, I'm surprised you didn't mention the fact that that particular bridge project came in ahead of time under budget.
That bridge project, I'm not talking about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Mr.
I know,
Chair,
but that was a big bridge project.
That is true, and it's true. Of the, it's indicative of the entire
that's
program.
That's peanuts compared to the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, very well appreciated.
The entire program is on time and under budget, and this particular bridge is on budget and 4 months ahead of schedule. So I think it's a good representation of the success of the entire program, and it's nearly a $200 million bridge that, again, we've had success working with the community, bringing it on time and under budget.
It's very well appreciated in Senator Edwards' district and mine. I'm just a curiosity question. I was noticing yesterday when I was driving over going south, I had never noticed it before, but the northbound bridge is higher than the southbound bridge. Is a reason for that?
Chair Beyer, I'm sure there is. I don't know.
Okay.
I can find that out for you, but I don't know. I think part of it may have to do with
but I always thought they were the same, but I was just driving by it and looked and said, huh.
There is a slight difference, yes. I'm sure it may have to do with the staging of construction that had that happen, but I can find out for you exactly why.
Okay. Just curiosity.
Staying in Eugene Springfield, another important project for some of the growth that we've seen in the Gateway area has been the Beltline I-5 project. We've completed Units 1 and 2. JTA provided funding for Units 3 and 4. Unit 3 is under construction now. As you drive down there, you'll see some of the work that's underway. K&E Contractors out of Salem also is the prime on this project. You see some of the improvements that are going on there as part of stage three. One of the important things I'll be doing this winter is continue to work on the bridge work and widening the bridge across I-5 for Beltline through this winter.
That was one that I would comment. It was while I was not in the legislature, but I think ODOT's initial design on that bridge project was a much better design than the one you accepted from the community what they wanted.
Yeah.
It's going to be a mess.
Happens regularly.
Huh?
That happens regularly.
Oh.
Another project just further south on I-5 is the Sexton Mountain Climbing Lane project. Here we were able to combine a JTA project, which provided a climbing lane on Sexton Mountain for about $10 million with a preservation project we already had planned. So it turned out to be about a $40 million project. We were able to have some efficiencies in combining our overlay project with the climbing lane project. Work was very aggressive this summer by Knife River out of Medford as they worked to add the climbing lane and do the paving. Here's a shot of the almost finished product on top of the pass. If you go down there today, it's actually open to traffic, that climbing lane. One sad note on this particular project, you may remember drew a blank on Brian Gray. Sorry, Brian Gray, the president of Knife River, was before you the last session talking about work zone safety. Mm-hmm. Knife River actually had one of their employees killed on this project by a distracted driver. So we'll probably be back before you talking about some other options. Our director has pulled together a committee with AGC, state police, and others to look at the problem of work zone safety. And we may be before you with some ideas of how we can improve work zone safety. One last project. This is on the south end of the Bend Parkway. It's what's called the Murphy Road 97 project. This also is a jobs and transportation project. It's really to complete that south end. If you're familiar with that area, if you're on 97 and you want to cut over on the old 97 or 3rd Street, there's a traffic signal. This essentially takes that traffic signal out and provides some grade separation for that movement, as well as provides an additional overcrossing of Murphy Road for local connectivity at that south end. Here's a picture of some of the work going on to build that overcrossing over 97 some of the work that's been going on. So quick overview of a few projects that we've had underway, just a sample of some of the work we've been doing this last summer.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Questions? Senator Rod?
Yeah, I know I brought this up last time, and I know you had a good answer, but in rural Oregon, there's two bottlenecks that come to mind. One is in Sisters, and one's in Lincoln City. Do you have any more ideas about what we can do in those two bottlenecks?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rod, we have projects in both those areas planned for the next couple years. Actually, the project in Sisters will happen this next spring, and then there's a project in Lincoln City, I believe it's the next summer. Relatively small projects to alleviate some of the congestion.
Is it at the bypass in Sisters, or what are you trying to – I'm just trying to visualize what you're doing. If you do the bypass, there's no light to get you back on – or whatever that is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, it's not the full bypass. The project will be to rebuild the section through downtown Sisters, but there will also be, in conjunction with that, we will be doing some signalization to facilitate the kind of the network of roads that exists to facilitate that bypass movement, but it's not improvements on the bypass itself, but there will be some improvements to facilitate those left turns off of US 20 to people that want to use that local bypass.
Okay, and Lincoln City was...
Lincoln City, we have a small project to one of the kind of the bottleneck areas in there where you go down to two lanes. We'll do some widening in that area, so we'll address a portion of the problem in those areas.
I'm trying to fix that for 20 years.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Both those are very difficult problems. I mean, we work with the communities and try to come up with solutions that really meet the goals of the community, as well as the through traffic that we're trying to facilitate, you know, from the state highway as well as the local communities.
City is particularly tough because there's absolutely no way to do a bypass there.
Yeah.
Well, you could do a partial one to around D Lake. Like West D Lake Road, if you straighten that out, that would kind of
is called
I-5. Probably half of it.
Mm-hmm. The bypass for Lincoln City is I-5.
Oh, now that's low. That is low. I'm quoting you in Lincoln
okay.
City.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not in your well, district. Well, I'll be the quoted in Lincoln City. Any other questions to Paul? Senator Monroe.
That's 205 right. Between Stafford Road and the Abernathy Bridge, where it goes down to two lanes, is a constant bottleneck. And I think the long-range plan was to add the third lane eventually there. It's really helped from Stafford Road to I-5, adding that third lane, and I just wondered what the timeline is to finish the project and get that third lane between Abernathy Bridge and Stafford Road.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I believe that's in the regional transportation plan to widen that, but at this point there's no funding identified for that work.
It just takes money, huh?
Right.
We might be talking about that in 2015.
Yeah. Support a discussion or package in 2015.
Well, it's absolutely critical, and whether or not they build the Columbia River Crossing Bridge, that's a bottleneck day, you know, not just morning and afternoon, but sometimes almost all day long.
Right. Anything else? Your concern is noted. It will be addressed in 2015.
I hope so.
Well, it'll be addressed. I'm not sure it'll be fixed. Thank you, Paul. We're going to move on. And I think we're up next to the wine industry.
No problem.
Is that right, Patrick?
Yes, indeed. How much is it?
So welcome.
$50 million?
No.
Less? How much?
Dan and...
I was with them 2 weeks ago. I was like
Tom?
Yeah.
Tom?
They said, damn, you're expensive.
Jan is going to come up too.
I was going to say, that didn't look like Tom.
Larry only cost me $182 million to get Larry.
Mr. Chair, while we're getting the technology straightened out, let me just do a quick introduction. Very happy to have Tom Donowski, who wears two hats. He's the director of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, which does the advocacy for the Oregon wine industry. Also is the director of the Oregon Wine Board, which is the entity that does marketing, research, promotion, education for the wine industry. Tom's been on the job a little less than 2 years. We're very honored to have him working with the wine industry in Oregon. He's got particular expertise and experience in marketing and branding for companies such as Chateau Chez Michel in Washington State, Coca-Cola, Kraft Foods, working in New York, Cutter & Buck, and he's also consulted other large companies like Microsoft and REI, which all of these companies have a particular interest in the retail marketing. So Tom is a native Oregonian, grew up in Beaverton, is a University of Oregon graduate. Would love to talk about the Ducks, but today's subject is the state of the Oregon wine industry, so I'll turn it over to Tom. And
but you didn't bring growlers.
I know. We did. Yeah, there you
go. Oh, the little one.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about the wine business. It's having a really, really terrific run. We have some information we want to share with you a little bit about it. I'm coming here today on behalf of the Oregon wine community. 545 wineries already, 905 growers who supply fruit to that business. Our board of directors and our staff of about six in Portland. So, I want to start by acknowledging and thanking all of you and all of your colleagues throughout the building for all the support that you give to the wine business. Not just the growler bill, but our land use, the work that was done to clarify that, and certainly things like Oregon Wine Month make a big difference for us. Something like a license plate is also another very, very helpful thing. It's also another thing that's only in Oregon. Nobody else has that. Your support makes a huge difference to all the people who are directly involved in the business and all the people who kind of circulate right around it. We're here today talking a little bit about kind of a progress report for you on the 10 years that have elapsed since the Oregon Wine Board was formed by legislation and with the governor's approval. As Dan mentioned, it was set up primarily to focus on marketing and promotion as well as the research that the grape growers and the winemakers need to continue to making the quality products that that are required here in Oregon. So our charter embraces all of those things, and in a lot of ways, the wine business here in Oregon is really a great metaphor for what's going on in some different sectors of our state's economy. For decades, it was basically a natural resource extraction kind of economy, and now as we rebalance, we have these kinds of products like wine or craft beer or craft distillery or artisan breads even. These premium branded consumer products that really wind up saying an awful lot about Oregon to those who come here and visit from outside our borders, and also really give a terrific sense of identity to rural communities and farming areas where grapes are grown and wine tourism is starting to take off. So I'm sure you probably get a lot of the questions that I often get, like, why is it so hard to find some Oregon wines on wine lists when I go on vacation, or what's happening with our friends up in Washington, what can we learn from them? And I'll touch on those as we go through, but let me press on and just give you a quick overview of the nine directors that I report to are all governor appointed, and they represent vineyards, they represent wineries with vineyards, they represent various corners of the state and large business enterprises as well as small and mid-sized. So it's a very diverse group that really, in a very positive way, reflects the diversity of our wine community. As you look at kind of what's gone on over the past decade since the Wine Board was formed, we've really built more strongly on that foundation and of pioneering spirit, and really solidified an exceptional reputation at the higher price points in the market for terrific wine quality that simply can no longer be ignored. It's one of the reasons why investment is coming to the Oregon wine business from France, from Washington State, from California, because those people are smart, they're savvy business people. They realize that Oregon has advanced to a position now where there is sufficient demand that they want to have Oregon in their wine portfolio. You get a fun little trip down memory lane here looking at some of our wine pioneers, and worried me just a little bit is a couple of these pictures were taken about 6 days ago, so I think our clothes have gotten better since since these pictures were taken. But it's an important marker in our business. the pioneering spirit of Oregon is really exemplified in the Oregon wine business. When so many people came here from other places and they were told they were crazy to try this, it would never work, and now it's a darn near $3 billion business. So it's a great testament to their capabilities and their abilities. A couple areas I want to focus on today, but I want to start just by giving you a real quick kind of a dashboard of how our Oregon business looks since the founding of the Wine Board 10 years ago, how it's progressed. You can see winery and vineyard counts are up, tonnage harvested. And in case you didn't know, the wine business initiated and asked and requested that their tonnage be taxed many years ago as a way of funding joint wine marketing efforts. They were finding years ago that there were just too many small associations popping up, everybody doing their own thing. The industry got together and figured out a way to put a little tax on themselves and fund the kind of work that we do to promote Oregon outside our borders. Here, our case volume has doubled, but there's still room to grow. But our focus at the Wine Board is not as much on case volume for growth's sake. It's more focused on trying to generate dollar volume increase rather than just case volume increases, because our wines tend to be premium priced. Yeah. The higher price points are where we really need to thrive, making research and technical support critical. It's also where restaurateurs and fine wine shop owners make a better margin on wine, making them more enthusiastic about supporting wines that generate high profits for them. So while we're not out there to gouge anybody, we acknowledge that the price of farming here can sometimes be a little bit higher for wine grapes than in other parts of the country, and that means that we really have to stand on quality. A couple of numbers from a study that was released in 2011 to give some dimension. And I'll come back in just a little bit and talk a little more specifically about a really rapidly accelerating part of the tourism business that affects us, and that's wine tourism. And I'll come and give you some numbers on that. This gives you just an overview, a complexion of how our state's 545 wineries kind of break out by their annual volume. And if you're like a lot of people seeing this for the first time, it catches you off guard. You might not be aware that 3 out of every 4 are selling about 5,000 cases or less. So while that might look like a community of very, very small brands, it is, but that's really a positive for Oregon. There really isn't a wine factory mentality here. These are not big brands. These are small artisan, handcrafted products, and that really plays well, especially when you're trying to explain to people why your wine is worth a little more. These are handcrafted small batch products, not unlike our colleagues in the craft beer or the craft distilling business. And that's where great brands are made that return the kind of economics that have to be returned in order for farming to make sense here. This might also catch you just a little bit off guard. It's a kind of a summary of the demand system for our wine broken out by price point. The left-hand side of that diagram is showing you how the overall wine categories volume segments by price. And then the right-hand side of that is just showing you our share, the Oregon side of the business. And you can see a dramatic skew towards those price points of about $12 and higher, and a real underperformance, and that's a good thing, an underperformance in the more popular price tiers. Not that Oregon doesn't have wines that can hit those price points, but we do, but the primary focus has been on the premium tier, and that's a very important thing when you're in a niche. We call ourselves sort of a region of discovery, and for a lot of people in the wine business, years ago, Oregon was a curiosity or something that was on the fringe. Now it's right in the mainstream, but at the very upper end of the quality perception of the mainstream. Give you a little sense of the market share positions that we're in. And again, I'm just focusing right here on those price tiers of about $12 and up per bottle, because that is really our area of focus. And while it may appear that we're small here, that's not necessarily a negative thing. This particular data tracking source shows you what's selling in grocery stores. It doesn't capture areas where we thrive, like restaurants or fine wine shops, but it's the available data that we have that gives the best view of how we compare sometimes to the other states. You can see right next to our red sliver of the pie is the light blue from Washington. And, of course, California continues to dominate, at least in this set of channels. As we improve our ability and expand our market research to capture more channels, we'll be able to give you a better representation. One of the things that is often asked is you know, why are these wines hard to find, or why am I often struggling when I leave the country or when I leave Oregon and go on vacation somewhere in the U.S.? Sometimes it's hard to find these. It's because, again, the price points we're competing at kind of narrow some of the distribution points that are available to us, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. We want to be in every place where a consumer is willing to pay more than $12 a bottle. And that has an implication for our distribution, but it's not always a negative. But just to give you a flavor of how we compare, you can see that while we're focused on building distribution, we want to build the right kind of distribution. It can be the kiss of death for a winery to go into a store or go into a restaurant and not perform. You'll get kicked off the wine list, you'll lose your space on the shelf, and it makes it harder for other Oregon wineries to get in there. So most of our wineries are very careful about expanding distribution where they feel they can sell, because that's critical. You're trying to develop a partnership, not just a transaction. One of our really, really critical partners is Linfield College, and I mentioned them along with Chemeketa Community College, Umpqua Community College, Oregon State. Linfield took the lead in a project that's really critical. They have some expertise in their business school that's not duplicated elsewhere in the state. They study reputation, how it relates to corporate reputation, brand reputation, and they adapted their thinking for helping us assess our region's reputation with respect to wine. And they talked to about 900 consumers across the country. Almost all of them lived outside Oregon, luckily, but they know enough about wine to answer these kinds of questions. And when you ask them what Oregon is known for, it's known for the kind of things that you want to be known for that are up here, the kind of things you want to be known for when you're trying to promote a premium-priced brand consumer product. Give you a little more flavor on that. The 928 respondents, 867 of those 928 immediately said high quality wines is a thing that they think of immediately when they're told that Oregon, you know, when they're asked about Oregon wine. And that's a little bit ahead of California, but certainly right within field goal range. Another couple attributes there that I've talked about before. I'll point you down to the fourth one on the list where it says a travel destination for wine tourism. That's a very good number for the number of years that we've been kind of slugging at it. There's room to move that needle up, but that's a huge economic driver for our business. Not just the wineries and the vineyards, but the ecosystem of other business that pivots off the wine business. They are whether you're a tour operator, whether you run a van company that takes tourists, you know, around to wine countries, whether you're hotels that are promoting wine tourism packages, there's a whole ecosystem that's thriving because the wine business is the piston driving that engine. One of the areas that I highlighted here in white at the bottom just gives you a flavor for our distribution opportunity. People who want to find us can't always find us. That is something we're trying to work on, but we want to make sure we're in the right stores where the consumers with the disposable income to invest in Oregon are able to do so. This just gives you a flavor for the importance, and it's probably not that unique to most other ag products, but the importance of your region. And it's one of the reasons why me and my team are focused on building brand Oregon and the reputational equity of brand Oregon and the wine
business. What's AVA?
AVA is called American Viticulture Area. It's a designation that you get from the Department of the Treasury, and it just means a distinct, unique region where wines of a certain flavor are from. Oregon has 17 designated AVAs. Two of those are shared with Washington. Like Walla Walla, you might think of it as Washington, but the AVA actually straddles both states. And in fact, most of the great grapes that are driving Walla Walla's quality reputation, most of the grapes are on the Oregon side. Same with the Columbia River Valley. There's an AVA there, but AVA just means American Bid Area. But it's really critical that we focus on Brand Oregon. You may or may not be familiar with this magazine. If you know a fine wine lover in your circle of friends, they're probably familiar with it. It's the top of the heap as far as consumer magazines. Gets about 3 million readers, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it gets the people who talk about wine, who know about wine, and it gets a lot of restaurateurs and wine retailers. When they do a cover story on Oregon, it matters.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
The question is, of all our wines, what's our most famous? Is it the Pinot Noir?
It is. It is. Oregon Pinot
Noir.
Do we have
a state wine by chance? Do you know?
Say.
No.
We do not have a state wine.
Do not have state grape.
Here comes the bill.
I think the state.
I mean, we have a state soil, for God's sake. So it's
yeah.
I see a wedge going right through there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll follow up with you offline.
it's a really good question, Senator. And
I don't know if that would cause conflict within the industry, but you know, I'm just throwing it out there.
I have it on my list of things to do on the very last day I hold this job. You know,
I'll let the Democrats do it.
Right. It's an interesting question, because for people who are new, and there still are many around the world that are new to the idea of Oregon wine, this is usually where the conversation starts. It's where we get most of the press.
I would think so.
Right behind it is Pinot Gris, our number one white wine. Right behind that comes Chardonnay, and we're a more diverse wine-growing region, but the first part of the conversation is almost always about Pinot Noir, and that's fine, because the write-ups like the one you're seeing here really get the attention of the fine wine retailers, restaurateurs, consumers who are into wine. One of the things that's fun to do is to look at their wine ratings, and the Wine Spectator gives wines a score from 0 to 100. And your first question might be, well, these are professional winemakers. Why aren't they getting 100-point wines? Nobody gets 100-point wines consistently. If you're Chateau, you know, Latour or Chateau Margaux, you might get it once every 3 years. But in the wine trade, a 90-plus score is a big deal. That's a wine your customer is going to come, and people do. They'll walk in with the magazine, and they'll point to that 94-rated wine, and they'll want it. So it's an important quality marker. And Oregon, when you rack up all of our wines that are rated by this particular publication, which again is the biggest consumer one in our category, 46% of our wines that are rated get that marker. And you can see how we compare to other regions, and you can see what the consumer pays for that. It's just another really interesting reinforcement of the quality reputation that Oregon continues to solidify. Another example, this one from another magazine, but a very influential writer named Robert Parker. If your wine friends don't know Robert Parker, they probably know his publication. This, when he writes something like this, it can move markets. And having him say something nice about Oregon really makes a difference. And it's just a further recognition that we continue to move and mature and move along the curve to being not just a region of discovery, but now a region where you simply want to have wines available to your customer, because they're going to come in and ask for it. One of the other things you have to address now is the continuing impact of younger consumers in our business. They shop online, they look online for recommendations, and the world's biggest online wine site is called Snooth.com, and they just picked Oregon as Region of the Year, and this will continue to reverberate very positively for us in 2014. Beyond the wineries, the grower community in Oregon, as I mentioned, numbers over 900. And this magazine, Wine and Spirits, picks one and just only one grower of the year. And this year it was from a grower named Di Crisp, who manages the Temperance Hill Vineyard with his wife, PK, and they run it right near Philomath. And he was selected as the grower of the year. And the wines that are made from fruit on this vineyard are among the top of the heap in Oregon, and it just continues to reinforce quality. But that's a very high honor, not just for the wineries, as I mentioned earlier, but to have an equal and equitable balance of acknowledgement for your growers is very important for a wine region that's looking to build its level of esteem. One of our other partners is Travel Oregon. They're a the other independent state agency, and they, of course, focus on outdoor activity and other things. And one of their main focuses for getting tourism here is focusing on wine and food. And we're trying to get them to focus just on wine, but they do a great job really marrying food and wine into a lot of their promotional programs, and they bring us in to a lot of things. To give you a sense of how the dashboard looks for wine tourism specifically, you can see these numbers, and we're up to over just over a million visitors a year now coming to Oregon and who are making wine a part of that travel itinerary. And that's pretty critical. For a lot of the smaller wineries in Oregon, getting that tasting room traffic is a great way to pour the wine, sell them wine if they want to take it home, but also, equally important, get them enrolled in a wine club where the wines are shipped to the consumer wherever they live 3 to 4 times a year. And it's a way to just kind of build evangelists all across the country after they've been to a tasting room. So wine tourism is a big deal, and it spawns a lot of other growth in related businesses just outside the tasting room. And some of the after behaviors, like wine adoption after our guests go home, continue to pay back really positively for us. Okay, thanks. Last couple points I'll mention about wine tourism, just kind of reinforce what I've said before. There's just no experience like visiting a winery in Oregon, because as our friends in Travel Oregon have said in some of their TV commercials, it's one of the very few places left in the world where you can go to a tasting room and probably have a pretty good chance of drinking wine with the winemaker. Sorry. One of the other things that's been really helpful and has been a great, great support is Oregon Wine Month, which we will have our third consecutive wine month this coming May. In fact, it's probably not too long that I may be coming back to you and asking you to consider designating a second month of the year as Oregon Wine Month, because getting a fall and a spring promotional window gives us a chance to get our local restaurants excited again about Oregon wine, get local stores to build displays around Oregon wine, and this license plate program that was kicked off in 2012 is, again, another example of a great partnership with Travel Oregon. The funding that is thrown off by this program is going to go into a grant administration program that we'll work with Travel Oregon on to award grants around the state in 2014 specifically to drive wine and culinary tourism. So that grant program will kick off next year. You might have heard of this program, or perhaps seen people who have, or run into people who know a little bit about it. Alaska Airlines has had a very successful program going on outside of our borders, where if you visit a wine region like Sonoma County and buy wine there, Alaska will waive the customary fee that they would normally charge you to check that wine and go home. They waive that in some smaller markets like Santa Rosa, California, or Walla Walla as a way of spurring traffic in some of their underserved markets. They were open for the first time to doing a program with us for 2 months that just concludes this week. That is a statewide program. So all 4 markets served by Alaska here in the state, Medford, Redmond, Oregon, Eugene, and Portland, all 4 Alaska markets here have now adopted this program. And our tasting rooms tell us that consumers know about it. People who are visiting here with their Alaska itinerary, they know about it, and it's driving some volume because of it. Probably the last thing that I'll touch on with respect to kind of the ecosystem around wine and wine tourism is all the events, like some of the ones represented by the logos on this slide, all the different events that attract people literally from all over the world and have been going on in the case of the IPNC, the International Pinot Noir Celebration, over a quarter century. These are things that on a lot of fine wine consumers' calendars, they are locked in. That's an anniversary event they do not want to miss. And our hosts at Linfield College just do a sensational job of rolling out the red carpet, and that's a sellout every year. But that's just one of many events. We had about 300 wine professionals from across the country in Portland last week for the Wine Tourism Conference, and it's hard to find a person in that audience who isn't looking to learn from what Oregon is doing. In fact, as I was driving in, I was thinking about what to say to kind of convey some of the enthusiasm that our wineries and vineyards have about how bright the future is. And I'm thinking about there's probably people like me sitting here talking in state capitals all around the country, and they're just dying to get what we have, which is a business that generates tourism, generates jobs, benefits rural communities, brands the state in a way that is so favorable. And I think the support that we've gotten from everybody in this building has been a huge, huge part of that. I'll start to wrap up here, but I know one of the questions I get as a former St. Michel guy is, why did you go to Oregon, and aren't you guys too small? And well, yes and no. We are small, but we are dramatically accelerating. And we're not small when you look at the dollar share of volume that fine wine consumers spend. I'll give you a flavor of how we compare to Washington. They've got a few more wineries than us, a significant amount more tonnage and volume and economic impact. But the growth curve in Oregon is steeper and more accelerated now because Oregon is being discovered in all the kinds of magazines that I've showed you. We're accelerating rapidly. And what's also good for Oregon wine in particular is that from sort of a macro viewpoint, demographically, more consumers are aging into those 40 and 50 and 60-year-old decades of their lives when their disposable income is up. And when they're now a little bit more open to food and wine travel. And so demography is really a tailwind now for the Oregon wine business. People are aging into those prime consumption years, and they're really interested to learn more about Oregon wine. So it's a great time to be doing what we're doing. Our friends in Washington, though, do have one really good head start on us. They have dramatically expanded their investment and their appreciation for technical support and research that drives their wine quality. And over on their Tri-Cities campus, they broke ground about a year and a half ago for a wine science center that was funded largely by private money, but the state did add $5 million to the fund for a total investment in the Wine Science Center, and they'll start getting their students in the fall of 14. We do have a secret weapon there. The guy who's administering it holds a master's from Oregon State, so he's kind of our inside guy who's very eager and anxious to find ways to collaborate scientifically so that all grape growers in the Northwest benefit from the work that'll be funded here. And I think I've touched on some of these points, but one thing I want to be sure to mention is that I'm sure you may want to know a little bit more or have some conversations perhaps directly with growers, and our Wine Growers Association will have the annual meeting here in Salem on January 15th. And that's a great chance if you're available to come over in the afternoon, and we'll be sure to get you invitations to talk directly with some of our wineries and growers about some of the challenges and opportunities they see ahead. Right after that, a month later, the end of February, is our big critical event. We'll have about 1,500 people here from all over the world at the Oregon Wine Symposium who want to know how we're doing what we do because they want to copy it in their state. So those are two critical events, January 15th and then February 25th.
So how much room is there for expansion? I mean, I've heard, and I'm not close to the industry at all, but I've heard that there's kind of a glut of wine now worldwide. Is that accurate?
You're right. There have been a lot of media reports. In fact, last year, 2012, Mr. Chairman, there was a record harvest in California. And to put some dimension around that, California is almost 100 times the size of our Oregon wine business. So despite that, record harvest in California, and certainly serious acceleration in quantity coming out of South America, Australia, New Zealand, and of course Europe, there's a relatively small part of the wine world that's represented by Oregon wine. But some of the headlines you've been reading are kind of because last couple of harvests, mainly in Europe, have been affected by weather. And we try to not talk so much about gluts or shortages because where we sit in Oregon, our ability to really influence the global wine supply is relatively small, but we have a disproportionate ability to represent the share of the wine market at the higher price points. Mm-hmm. So our opportunities for expansion continue to be primarily in distribution and more availability for Oregon wines, and that's really where our focus is. There will continue to be some acreage additions, but probably not as dramatically as we've seen over the last 10 years. We'll also see improved yields per acre in some areas. So we will see some expansion, I'm sure, but our main thrust has been to try to focus on getting more than our fair share of the volume that is at the price points that return decent economics to our farmers. And last the point I'll touch on is just looking ahead. Some of the money that was made available for fermentation sciences in the last session was a really great start at not only funding wine research. There was about $1.2 million given to Oregon State for fermentation sciences. But not only did the wine category benefit, but our colleagues in craft beer, in cheese, in bread, in other fermentation science disciplines, they also benefited. But certainly in wine, at the price points we need to win at, continued investment in technical research to drive quality is essential. And the investments that have been made so far are really helpful. You've heard me talk a little bit about expanding availability, but focusing on those places where our consumer shops. And the last point is to continue to drive wine tourism so that our wineries have a chance not only to capture customers in the tasting room, but turn those into wine club members who go home and talk about Oregon. So you may have some more questions, but thank you for this chance to talk about the wine business and report on what's going on.
Senator Monroe, please.
Yes, one of the things you didn't mention in terms of wine tourism was runners. There was an article in the Runner's Magazine about Oregon wine, and the tagline was that there's an annual road race in somewhere in Yamhill County, there were only about 1,000 or so runners, but a lot of the runners come from other states. Runners tend to be people that have a little bit of disposable income, and talked about the experience they had running the race and then having a little wine and cheese afterwards and so on. And it was a very good article, a very positive article for Oregon, I thought. So you don't want to forget about that. Oregon is known as the running state. The running boom kind of started in Oregon, and there are a lot of small and sometimes not so small road races, and tying them to the wine experience, I think, is a very positive thing.
I think you're right. Thank you for that comment, Senator Monroe, because I think you might be referring to something called the Fueled by Wine Half Marathon. And I'm a runner, but I haven't had the stamina for that one because they hold it on a wickedly hot weekend every July. But it is an integration of some two things that Oregon is very well known for. And coming right on the back of that is a specific area of the tourism economy that involves not only running and wine, but bike touring and wine.
Yes.
And there's
yes.
two things going together, and we're continuing to look for ways to partner in the most intelligent and thoughtful way with our friends at Travel Oregon, who drive both of those things for us. But thank you for mentioning that. You're right.
Excellent.
Very good point.
Any other questions? Comments? Thank you, Tom.
Good
report.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thanks,
it.
Thanks for all your support of the wine business.
Good luck.
Good.
All right, Patrick, one left, huh?
Yes, sir.
Bureau of Labor.
We're here. There you go.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Germanson. I am the manager of the Bureau of Labor and Industries Technical Assistance for Employers Program, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak very briefly about the services that BOLI provides for Oregon employers. This is a chart of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. There are four major missions to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have the Apprenticeship and Training Division, which is the educational component of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have the Civil Rights Division and the Wage and Hour Division, which are our two enforcement divisions. And then we have the Technical Assistance for Employers program, and this is the part of the agency that's responsible for educating and advising Oregon employers on wage and hour laws, civil rights laws, and other employment laws related to the laws that Boley enforces. And we have a firewall between Technical Assistance for Employers and the enforcement parts of the agency. We are a safe harbor for employers. We are the area where an employer can contact us and ask about wage and hour laws, minimum wage, overtime, rest and meal periods. They can ask about civil rights laws. They can ask about disability accommodation and protected family leave and other employment-related issues. Often an employer will call us just to ensure they're heading down the right path with an employee and they're not violating any laws. So we really find ourselves being in the position of helping these employers prevent making a wrong step and having to talk to the enforcement sides of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. There's a firewall. We don't have access to current claims. We can't talk about a current action that's going on. And we also don't advise the enforcement parts of the agency that we've talked to an employer who may be in violation of the law. This is a small program. We have 6 employees total with Technical Assistance for Employers. There's a manager, myself, I have an administrative person, and there are 4 trainers. And this is what we do for employers. We have an employer assistance phone line. This is a dedicated number as well as an email service where an Oregon business can contact us. They have a question about an employment law. They give us a call. In the past, because the unit is so small and we were receiving so many phone calls, we were only able to take phone messages. We would respond within 24 hours. We found employers found this very, very difficult because if you're dealing with a final paycheck issue or a difficult employee issue, you want to talk to someone right away. And so several weeks ago, we were able to switch our phone line, so we were able to pick that phone up. It rings to all 6 desks, and in most cases, there's someone there available. Answer that phone call, provide information to that employer at that time. This has been phenomenal. We have had a lot of instances where we've had a lot of hang-ups because I think people are not prepared to get an actual live body on the phone to ask that question. In the last year, we answered around 18,000 employer inquiries, and 98% of those responses were within 24 hours or less. Even with employers having to leave a message on that phone line, in 98% of the time, we were able to get back to that employer within the same day or within 24 hours. We also write employer advice columns, and these are columns on current topics of interest. As an example, right now we're writing several employer advice columns on holidays, holiday pay, as well as religious issues around the holidays that employers have to deal with. These are sent to 37 different media outlets, as well as chambers, several business associations. They're also posted on the Boley website. These are written in the form of kind of a Dear Abby type of format. They're written in very easy to understand language, and they're based upon the inquiries that we're getting currently, so they're very topical. We also have the Boley website. Our Technical Assistance for Employers website has over 100 frequently asked questions and fact sheets on common topics of interest to employers. As an example, our fact sheet on rest and meal period rules is probably the most accessed part of those fact sheets. This is something employers can post on a bulletin board if their employees have questions about the working conditions. They can put them in an employee's paycheck stub. And those fact sheets are frequently updated because laws change. We want to ensure that employers have the most up-to-date information. There are a number of new laws going into effect January 1st of 2014, and we are prepared to have those posted right away. In some cases, we've got them posted already because those employers are starting to ask us questions. These are the services that are provided at no charge to employers. Technical assistance is primarily an other-funded program, which we're primarily self-supporting. And so the way we support ourselves is by conducting public seminars throughout Oregon. Right now we have 13 different seminars that we can train on, anywhere from wage and hour laws, the Oregon Family Leave Act, leave laws in Oregon, which is a two-day seminar that covers the Oregon Family Leave Act, the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, leave for victims of domestic violence, and the various other leaves that employees are entitled to, regardless in some cases of the size of the employer. For example, disability accommodation will apply in Oregon if you have one employee. So that seminar is a pretty intensive two-day seminar. We also conduct supervisory seminars. We have a two-day employee supervision seminar that's very well attended. And then at the latter part of 2012, we decided to roll out a six-month new supervisor series. And this is a six-month series. It is a half day a month, and each session builds on the session before it. So at the end of 6 months, brand new supervisors have a pretty good basic understanding of an employment law. This came about because we're finding that the enforcement divisions are saying oftentimes an employer had a complaint filed against it because a supervisor was not aware of the law. So this is very basic information and really intended to keep employers out of trouble in compliance with the law. And I think at $260 for 18 hours worth of training, it's a pretty good investment, because I can guarantee an attorney is going to charge a little bit more than $260 to defend some type of a claim filed against it. We're also planning to expand that six-month supervisor series and do a session in Salem so we can work specifically with state agencies on providing new supervisor training specific to working with a collective bargaining agreement and working in the state system. We also conduct on-site seminars. These are customized seminars that are contracted with us by specific employers, or many times business organizations will have us come out, train a bunch of employers in their area. We've developed a partnership with the Oregon Employer Council, which is the nonprofit council associated with each of the Oregon Employment Department field offices. And I believe there are 27 of them throughout Oregon. That has been a crucial partnership. When we conduct public seminars, for example, in Ontario or in Grants Pass, we were finding that it didn't cover our costs to go and conduct training in those more remote locations from Portland, because many employers say, I can't be away from work for an entire day. I have a small business. I have to be here. And further, sometimes the costs were a little bit high for some of those employers to attend a full-day seminar. Through the partnership with the Oregon Employer Council, we are able to conduct training in more the smaller areas of the state. Generally, those are three-hour seminars, because small businesses would prefer to attend a half-day training at a much lower cost, because we're working with the employer council to get bodies in the seats. For example, last June, we conducted a seminar in partnership with the Oregon Employer Council in Klamath Falls, and we had 92 attendees. That's pretty significant for such a small area. And we try to lump our seminars in different parts of the state. For example, when we go to Eastern Oregon, we'll train in Ontario. Then we'll go to Baker City. Then we'll go to LeGrand. Then we'll go to Pendleton. So we're able to do a series of seminars in Eastern Oregon, for example, and sometimes employers will follow us to each one of those seminars, because when you live in Ontario, it's nothing to drive 120 miles to the next location. That has been a crucial partnership. It's allowed us to get to conduct training in all parts of the state. And out of the 138 seminars we conducted in the last year, 65 of those were outside of Portland, Salem, Eugene. We were in Grants Pass, Klamath Falls, Burns, Redmond, Medford, Roseburg. So we're all over the state, Brookings. So we are all over the state, and really I'm finding that employers in those areas of the state have found this to be very valuable, to have someone in front of them. They get the training. They can ask the questions. We also publish 8 different employer handbooks. These are handbooks on wage and hour laws, civil rights laws, family leave laws, employee management, documenting, disciplining, and discharging employees. We published a relatively new handbook on child labor laws in Oregon. These are updated every 2 years. So right now we have updated for 2014 the Family Leave Laws Handbook that covers the Oregon Family Leave Act, the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, the various leaves that employers must comply with in Oregon that can be somewhat complicated at times. And we've greatly expanded that to include injured worker types of issues, reinstatement, reemployment. There are a lot of questions about that. That will be available by the first week of December in time for our annual employment law conference. We also have an annual employment law conference. This year's our 29th. It's a two-day conference held in Portland at the Oregon Convention Center that generally attracts around 350 attendees. The posters that are required by many state and federal agencies for employers to post are also available on our website. They are free for download at no charge. So employers can go in and print off that minimum wage poster or the Oregon Family Leave Act poster. It's not going to cost them a thing. Many poster companies prey on some of the smaller employers in this state. They call us. They say, I just got a letter saying I have to pay $125 for a set of posters or I'm going to be getting a lot of fines. And we've explained to those employers, those are not sent to them by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. They are private poster companies. Boley provides those posters at no charge on the website, as well as we provide our own composite poster for $10. And our 2014 posters will be available the first week of December as well. This is just some statistics for the last program year showing what this unit has done. Over 12,000 posters and handbooks were sold, 55 public seminars, 78 on the customized seminars, and again, 65 of those were conducted outside of Portland, Salem, Eugene, generally in conjunction with Oregon Employer Council. We have also begun working with chambers and small business development centers to get us to those parts of the state. Just a colorful slide of our current handbook offerings. Again, the 2014 Family Leave Laws Handbook, the purple book, is ready to go. It's at the printer right now. That is going to be our biggest seller. There's a lot of interest in this topic. This is written in a way that employers are able to take a look and just follow a progression, kind of a flow chart of how do I apply this.
Are these available online as well?
Chair Byer, they are not available online. We are looking at ways to have a subscription service, but the sales of the publications and posters are the primary support for the unit. The Wage and Hour Handbook will be updated for 2014. There have been some changes, and the Civil Rights Handbook will also be updated for 2014. So again, we try to update these on an every two-year rotation. Last year, we had a brand new handbook, the Employee Classification and Wage and Hour Exemptions. That was developed as a result of all the questions that we get on those topics, and that has been very, very valuable, I believe, to employers. And just highlights for the last year, we developed six brand new seminars. I talked about the life of a workers' comp claim. We have a new seminar on developing an employee handbook. For smaller employers, we have found that many times they will contact us with a question about a practice and want to know what the law is, and many times it's going to be based upon what's in the employer handbook. That has been a very well-attended seminar. So the six new seminars that we developed in the last year, the brand new six-month new supervisor series, when we started that, we thought we would have a limit of 35 attendees because that's optimal for training, so you can talk to everyone. We had 52 people register for the first one, and we've now decided, as a result of our experience, that we do need to cut that down and keep it at the 35. It appears that for 2014, the seminar that we're starting in January, we may have to add a second series due to the demand for that. We've updated the handbooks or new updated or provided the new handbooks for employers. Again, we're really proud of the fact that we're doing more than, 65 of our seminars are in rural areas of Oregon. This is crucial. We were in Brookings several months ago, and the employers there, while not a huge group, were ecstatic that Boley was there conducting this training. You can do webinars, and you can have information posted on the website, but I think having an actual expert there to provide the training, to answer your questions, to provide tips and tools and techniques to keep you in compliance with the law is crucial. And those folks in Brookings were pretty happy to see us there. That's going to continue. We're really working on our outreach and our partnership with the Oregon Employer Council. We're working with the Small Business Development Centers, and we're also trying to outreach to chambers. I talked to the chamber director in Hermiston, I get Hermiston and Enterprise mixed up, Hermiston last week, and we talked about getting Boley out there in February or March to conduct training. They have a lot of interested employers. We're going to try to work with the Oregon Employer Council in that area to get even more folks in there, which will keep the cost much, much lower for those employers who are going to attend those seminars. And this is just a map of everywhere we trained in the last year. So we do get around. We were in Burns. We do a number of seminars in Ontario. Again, Brookings, Grants Pass, Klamath Falls. We really are attempting to get to all parts of the state. Recently conducted new seminars in Astoria and Lincoln City, and they were extremely well attended. I told you I keep it short. Okay. Any questions for me?
Senator Rudd.
Yeah, I need to follow up on what Senator Beyer asked, and that is to get family leave information off the Internet, you have to, first of all, it's not available, or you have to buy a publication from you. I have to tell you that that really rubs me the wrong way, because you are the authority on that, and if they can't get that information, then you are going to fine the hell out of them. So I see that as a way to pad your budget, and I don't like it. I'm just done.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, I'm Audubon. I'm the legislative director for Boley, and I understand your concern. I will say that we do have fact sheets on our website that are separate from technical assistance for your kind of information that you're talking about. Technical assistance is really just a wonderful resource, but I wanted to highlight it here because it is a wonderful resource for employers, and they do have to charge for their services because they are self-sustaining. Maybe we can talk further about your other issues.
Boley has a long reputation of not being very kind to industry, and this just seems to be something that just flies in the face of reason. I belong to a dental board, and I got to tell you, I'm dealing with a problem right now within the dental board, same thing. The information didn't go out how they were going to enforce the law. People didn't do the law, they didn't abide, and they're getting fines up to $12,000, which goes back to the board. Well, I just think that there's a positive feedback loop here where information should be free to those people that are going to be enforced. I really truly believe that. I don't care if it's a technical, and if you're self-sustained, that's within that agency. It isn't something that we put restrictions on you to do. So, you know I love you. But this is a hotbed of problems, and the Bureau and Boley has a bad image with labor. I mean, with industry. So,
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, one reason I wanted to make sure Jennifer came and talked, because I think that this is part of the agency that maybe you don't hear very much about, and their whole purpose is to help employers. And I don't think there is any other resource that an employer can pick up a phone and get a live person on the other side to answer questions, and that part is free. And the reason they can do that part is because they do the seminars, they do the books. And that I'm not sure if the example that you gave, they picked up the phone and talked to Boley, but that's something they could have done.
Other questions? Thank you very much, Jennifer. Appreciate
Thank you.
It. Okay, anything else for the good of the order? I will note that our newest colleague is to be sworn in about 2 minutes. So we are adjourned.